Hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Chris Hutton. Let's get into the first news story of today. And this is the question of why there has been so little load shedding recently. Now, I think we've had the longest streak of without load shedding so far this year. It's been about 13 days or so, just around 2 weeks. We've also beaten, I think, last year's streak without, except for the very end of the year. Without load shedding, which happened right in the December holidays when there wasn't a lot of electricity demand. And there are a lot of questions as to why has load shedding been reduced so much at this time of year. Now, the cynic in me says that, and I'm sure the cynic in many South Africans says that this is possibly due to trying to look good for the election. Of course, load shedding is always very damaging to the ANC's reputation. However, a number of independent energy experts say that really there actually are a number of factors coming together that just happen to be reducing load shedding at the moment. One of them being Chris Yaland, who said that he thinks that the maintenance work being done on Eskom facilities is actually proving to be more successful. He said that the number of hours of unplanned outages was down, and that they were actually doing more planned outages, which allowed them to sort of manage the system better, and that essentially the maintenance was being more effective. Of course, the other major factor in reducing load shedding appears to have been the huge uptake of solar systems and other sort of private or micro electricity generation systems by everything from businesses to households across the country. However, I must say, while I think that Yaland and some of the other independent energy experts make a convincing case that there is definitely some change in the way in the electricity system, which is resulting in Eskom here doing better, I remain skeptical that the election has absolutely nothing to do with this. And I wonder just how much Eskom is being fed in terms of extra money for things like diesel and maintenance that it wasn't normally able to do, which will be pulled after the election. I may be wrong. I am just speculating here. But I will say on air that I would not be terribly surprised if suddenly stage four starts on May the 30th. Chris, am I being too cynical? What do you make of this? You've looked a little bit at Eskom's reports on how effective they are at producing electricity so far this year. What have you seen?
So partly what is helping is unplanned outages. The level of those have come down compared to what they were at this point last year and also throughout last year when we saw continued ramping up to higher stages of load shedding. What is most noticeable to me is, especially last year, was the ramping up and ramping down between more intense stages, which to me indicated a low operating reserve or operating margin, maybe 2,000 megawatts at the most. When things go badly, then it sort of snowballs. So if something happens at one of the major power stations, not necessarily the newer ones, the older ones, the coal-fired power stations that provide the bulk for Eskom's generation, when issues happen there, it all snowballs. If you then get less from your contracted sources like solar, wind, et cetera, it just makes Eskom's operating margins all the more difficult. So at the moment, I think there's an element of less planned maintenance going into this where, but this has been the case for years now, when Eskom almost kicks into touch the issue of having to do maintenance now, when you have to take parts of your fleet offline, whole stations, parts of stations. It's short-term pain for long-term gain, but you don't want to do it, especially in an election year, because that inevitably means shortages and then more intense load shedding. I don't want to discount the help that is being afforded to Eskom by the private sector in terms of solar capacity, et cetera, but that's not dispatchable energy. So it's not useful for big industry, your mines, your smelters, that sort of thing. So I wonder what contingencies they've put in place to help mitigate the risk from Eskom's side as well. At the moment, it's a tricky picture to try and figure out, because I think what has been the two big reliant things on which Eskom has relied over the last few years is the diesel supply for the open cycle gas turbines, which are not designed to be run 24/7. And then secondly, relying on putting off maintenance, as it were. So We'll see pretty soon, I think, whether these two things are the case. If they catch up with Eskom, for example, if they have to ask for more in terms of a diesel budget, if they run out of diesel supply for the open cycle gas turbines, or if we've got more intense load shedding because they just have to ramp up the maintenance because they didn't plan accordingly. So I think the picture is too good to be true, and I don't think the burden of proof has by any means been shifted yet. That is on Eskom at the moment. So let's see. I think the next 2 to 3 weeks will be quite indicative of what trend line we're looking at.
Indeed. It's one we will be closely watching to see whether Eskom is able to actually hold things together. It is worth pointing out that I think our former CEO of the IRR, former colleague, Franz Cronier, did suggest that major improvements in the load shedding situation would be possible if certain changes were made. Now, I don't think those changes have been made, but that was an interesting piece. He said this, I think it was last year, because it suggests that with proper oversight, we actually may be closer to fixing load shedding than many have thought. Although the jury is still out on all of this, so we shall have to see what comes of it. particularly if it does go to stage four after May the 30th, I will be rather amused if somewhat annoyed. Okay, let's go to our next story, and this is about the city of Joburg. So I think it was either last week or the week before on the show, we talked about the city of Joburg making a provision that would allow most of its councillors or all of its councillors to more easily get access to bodyguards to protect them in the city of Johannesburg. And we're getting more details now from the Daily Maverick story reporting by Ferial Hafaji about specifically what Joburg is actually doing when it comes to bodyguards. And, oh boy, there's a lot of stuff being given to to senior leaders of the Joburg government. Not only are senior leaders in the Joburg government getting a large number of bodyguards. So, for example, Kabelo Gumanda is getting 10 bodyguards. By comparison, the DA mayor, Paul Palatse, got 3 bodyguards. And Jordan Hill Lewis, the mayor of Cape Town, apparently has 4 bodyguards, according to this story. So Joburg's mayor is getting twice as many bodyguards. The speaker of the city of Joburg, Margaret Arnolds, from the African Independent Congress, will have 8 bodyguards. And all of the senior members of the Joburg government are also getting a convoy of cars to follow them around from the Johannesburg Metropolitan Police. Those police cars, one would presume, should be rather enforcing bylaws, making sure the traffic flows smoothly. I remember when I was a City of Joburg councillor that JMPD did often complain about not having enough cars to do sort of some of its work. However, there's going to be 40 cars taken from the fleet of JMPD to serve as, I don't know what, convoy cars for the senior leadership of the city of Johannesburg. And this really suggests that the city of Joburg is, quite frankly, just sort of being cynically looted at this point. It's very difficult to square this at all with the numerous service delivery crises which are breaking out the city, which, to be fair, the water stuff is not entirely a city of Johannesburg problem in the sense that it's not entirely their fault. But, you know, why would you do this just before an election? Chris, what do you make of this?
Convoy cars for the commissars. Maybe that should have been the tagline or the headline that the Daily Maverick went for. Because I think this reinforces, it would be unfair to say it reinforces the perception of all politicians, but of at least many of those in the Joburg Council, City Council, that there's a clear separation between the kings and queens and then the rest of the population, where they need protection. It doesn't matter what that does to the rest of the budget. We've got ratepayers under enormous pressure from all sorts of avenues, still trying to pay their rates and their taxes to try and provide some revenue stream for the city, for that to be used for things like infrastructure maintenance, upgrading, water, electricity, waste removal, basic service delivery. Although when citizens try and do that, I think it's going to ratchet up once again the tension between citizens and local government and possibly lead to either protests, boycotts, some different breaks in different ways, and how to reestablish that trust and that relationship becomes very difficult over time. I think the longer this sort of abuse, I think, continues, this abuse of citizens' resources, of state resources. When you look at heading into national and provincial elections that should be as hotly contested as all the polls indicate, with the decline of the ANC especially, then you become even more concerned about what institutions are being put in place, what rules, what stopgaps, what measures to ensure that resources that are collected now in terms of taxes are spent well over long term. It doesn't matter just whether you and your friends are in city council, but what that you're doing what is best for the citizens who are trying their best to pay their rates, as I said, run businesses, look after their families, all that sort of thing. So it shouldn't be a surprise, I think, given the trend line of the city of Joburg management, if I can use that term, over the last 3 to 4 years, very much expected that it would reach these sorts of levels. I guess it now remains to be seen how ridiculous it's going to get. But again, it's good that the information is out there. You know, share this sort of thing, share this info with people around you, with people in your street, all that kind of thing. You never know what particular story in isolation, but maybe everything together gets people to turn out on the 29th of May and vote accordingly.
I must say, when the story first came out, I was a little bit sympathetic to the idea that councillors do actually need easier access to protection. Being a city councillor or a councillor in South Africa, particularly in KZN, is possibly the dangerous job in the country, even more so than police officers or firemen or security guards or things like that, in terms of the sheer number of them who are murdered or shot at. And we have had we've had a successful assassination in the city of Johannesburg. But when you see all of these extras, like the obscene number of bodyguards, the extra convoys, all these things, it's really clear that this stuff is done for reasons other than just pure protection, as a lot of it is for status. All right, let us move on to our last story. And this is that the Department of Transport has asked South Africa's biggest corporate lobby group, Business Unity South Africa, to assist it in fixing basically the freight and passenger railways. Now, there's been a lot of talk about this over, I would say, at least the last year, that there was going to be some sort of public-private partnership on getting some of the rail lines to be fixed. We've already seen some deals move forward on that. Some of them fall apart. Some of them, I think, are still moving ahead. But this is quite interesting to me in the larger context, because I think it dovetails with another piece of info coming out from government, with Paul Mashatile inviting Afroforum and Solidarity to join government plans to try and fix the water systems, particularly in Gauteng, just ahead of the election. And Chris, I do wonder whether there's an attempt here by government to sort of co-opt business and civil society groups into solving some problems in the short term, and then, you know, once the election is further away, jump them back out and go back to how things were. What do you make of this?
Or at the very least, wanting to look like they're trying to solve the problem, so wanting some good PR before the elections, but you don't actually make the concessions and the legislative changes, the policy reforms, to lessen your control over a given area. So in logistics, for example, last year there was the sort of auctioning or opening up a tender process for private sector players to take over parts of different railway corridors. I think about between 15 and 13 initial bidders, and that was whittled down to about two. And part of the reason behind that was the requirements of that process, where Transnet remained the ultimate custodian of the infrastructure. So you get private sector investment going, ownership, ask private sector companies to invest billions, if not more, which you need in terms of these large-scale capital projects for rail. But then Transnet can make the ultimate decisions about what happens with the infrastructure, who can access it, etc. So that's not to say that this kind of talk won't manifest in something positive, but again, that burden of proof, the ideological burden of proof, hasn't been shifted, and definitely the practical burden of proof hasn't been shifted. There's a company based in the Philippines coming in at Pier 2 at Durban Harbour. That process was supposed to be completed in April. It has now been pushed back to May or even June. You still need union approval of the deal. There are issues around one bidder competing with another bidder. So what were the terms? Was there preferential, some element of preference, et cetera, et cetera? So I think it's going to be a difficult process to see how it all manifests. And partly what could be behind the delays is useful for those in government who want to retain state monopolies over certain SOEs and industries where they can say, we tried to open up to the private sector, but they didn't come to the party. So you see, we shouldn't try this privatization thing. It's a useful narrative point, and I think it's something to keep in mind.
Yes, yes. Now, there's a lot of perverse political incentives here to not make these public-private partnerships work as they should. All right, let us call it to a close there. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show interesting. That's a wrap.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.